I want you to try and imagine something for a second. Think about a single biological cell just floating there under a microscope.
Okay.
Now, put that next to the complex workings of the human mind,
Right.
add a massive bureaucratic legal system,
Uh-huh.
and then finally zoom all the way out and picture an entire human civilization operating on a global scale.
I mean, you are spanning basically every scientific discipline we have right there,
Yeah.
from cellular biology to psychology, all the way up to like macro sociology.
Exactly. And they seem completely different.
Right.
They operate on totally different scales. They're made of completely different materials. But what if I told you they are all built using the exact same architectural blueprint?
It sounds impossible.
It does. But the framework we are looking at today attempts to do what usually sounds, well, insane. It tries to unify biology, sociology, and physics under one single continuous theory of organization.
Right, without just reducing human behavior to, atoms bouncing around.
Exactly. So today, we are cracking open the foundational texts of the PSE research program. Specifically, we're looking at three monographs written by Harry C.J. Stolting
Yeah, including the canonical glossary.
and the Ontology of Organization.
Right. And these texts are, I mean, they are dense.
Oh, yeah.
They're interdisciplinary masterclasses in systems theory, because Stolting is asking a question that most scientific disciplines just skip over entirely.
Which is,
What makes organization itself possible in the first place?
yeah.
Like, before we even start talking about what a specific thing is made of.
Right. So our mission today is to provide a really clear, accessible overview of this massive program, a structured deep dive, if you will.
Sounds good.
We are going to map out how organization emerges out of chaos, how it manages to survive, and why brilliant systems sometimes completely collapse.
Yeah.
But to understand how this framework links a microscopic cell to a sprawling civilization, we have to start at the absolute beginning, the engine of the entire theory.
The principle of systematic exclusion.
Yes, the PSE.
The namesake of the entire program, actually.
Right.
And the core premise here flips our usual intuition completely upside down.
How so?
Well, we typically think that to build a system, you have to add things together, right?
Yeah, like you gather bricks to build a wall.
Exactly. But the principle of systematic exclusion posits that coherent organization doesn't emerge through addition. It emerges purely through the continuous active exclusion of incompatible possibilities.
Wow. So it's not about what you put in.
No.
It's entirely about what you aggressively leave out.
Yes. Let's trace the ontological sequence Stolting lays out. Everything starts with reality,
Okay, reality.
right? The total, undivided, chaotic field of all existence.
Sounds messy.
It is. Then you have a context. And within that context, a distinction is made. Something separates this from that.
Okay, a distinction, but just pointing out a difference doesn't build a system, right?
Exactly. Merely pointing it out isn't enough. To get from a fleeting distinction to an actual surviving entity, you need exclusion.
So if we look at how that plays out at the physical level, it actually makes perfect thermodynamic sense.
It really does.
Think about a primordial soup. You have all these chemicals swirling around in total chaos. To get a biological cell, you first need a lipid bilayer, like a primitive membrane.
Right.
And that membrane doesn't just passively sit there. Its entire job is to systematically exclude the surrounding water and chaotic chemical reactions.
And that chemical exclusion is what generates a boundary.
A boundary.
Yeah. By continually pushing away incompatible interactions like toxins or destructive energy, the boundary creates a safe internal space.
Makes sense.
And once you have that boundary, you get constraints. The system is now limiting what can happen inside it. It's reducing the infinite chaotic degrees of freedom down to a manageable few.
Which mathematically guarantees what the monographs call selective persistence.
Exactly.
Because you've constrained the chaos, the system doesn't immediately dissolve back into entropy. It holds its shape.
It survives.
Reading through this, the analogy that kept coming back to me was Michelangelo carving the statue of David.
Oh, that's a good one.
Right. The art, the actual structure of the masterpiece, isn't in the marble that Michelangelo added.
No, of course not.
He didn't build David block by block. The statue emerges purely through what is systematically excluded, chiseled away, and left on the floor.
That captures the underlying logic beautifully. The chisel is systematic exclusion.
Yeah.
If a system stops actively chiseling away incompatible interactions, it loses its constraints. It dissolves back into the block of marble.
It returns to the primordial soup.
Exactly. We are so used to hearing the word exclusion in a negative sociological context.
Like marginalizing a group of people.
Right. But in this fundamental ontological sense, exclusion is the ultimate generative, creative force of reality.
It's the only way you get a stable identity.
Yes.
Okay, so exclusion is the universal chisel. But if we take that idea and try to scale it up, I feel like we hit a massive conceptual wall. Well, I have to challenge the idea that this same chisel carves both a cell and a human society.
Okay, yeah.
Because sociologists and historians have traditionally hated it when theorists try to apply biological rules to human institutions.
Oh, with good reason.
Right. Whenever we try to say a society is just a biological organism, we usually end up in incredibly dark, reductive places.
Also Darwinism.
Exactly. Where we justify crushing weak institutions because, quote, that's just nature.
So how does Stulting avoid falling into that trap?
That is the crucial pivot of this entire framework. And the text is meticulously careful to avoid that reductive trap.
Okay, good.
The concept you're pointing to is called organizational scale invariance. The framework is absolutely not claiming that a society is a giant biological organism.
Right.
The actual physical mechanisms are completely different at different scales.
Meaning a society doesn't have a literal metabolism or a plasma membrane.
Precisely. That would be the opposite of what he's saying. It's not reducing sociology to biology. A cell uses physical chemistry to survive.
A society uses communication, abstract laws, shared cultural norms, economic structures. The building materials have nothing in common.
Okay, so what is invariant then?
What scales up perfectly, regardless of the medium, is the organizational logic.
The logic?
Yes. The sequence of distinction, exclusion, boundary, constraint, and identity. That operates exactly the same way.
Let me see if I can map that logic onto an abstract system, like a legal framework.
Go for it.
In a legal system, the boundary isn't a physical wall made of lipids.
No.
The boundary is conceptual. The law establishes a boundary by determining what is legal versus what is illegal.
Right.
It systematically excludes certain behaviors, theft, violence, fraud. Mm. And it does that to constrain the chaos of human interaction. By excluding those incompatible behaviors, the society achieves selective persistence. It doesn't rip itself apart.
You've hit the nail on the head. Both the cell and the legal system use systematic exclusion to maintain their boundaries, even though they're built out of completely different stuff. And to push this even further, the framework points out something profound about biological survival to prove this relational point. Think about the old adage that every 7 years, almost all the cells in your body have been replaced.
Oh, the biological ship of Theseus.
Exactly.
You are not made of the same physical matter you were a decade ago.
Right. So what is actually surviving? It's clearly not the material matter. The matter is temporary.
Okay.
What survives is the persistence of relational organization. The intricate relationships and boundaries between the parts, they persist, even as the physical parts are constantly swapped out and recycled.
And when you apply that to human systems, it clicks perfectly.
Yeah.
Think about the Supreme Court, or a medieval university, or the Catholic Church.
Great examples.
These institutions have survived for centuries. Every single original human being who built them is long dead.
The matter has been entirely replaced.
Countless times. But the relational organization, the rules, the boundaries, the selective exclusion of who gets to be a judge or a priest, that is what persists.
It is a stunningly elegant way to unify the sciences without collapsing them into each other.
It really is.
But as we move up the scale, we encounter a radical shift in how systems interact with their environment.
Okay, what changes?
Well, biological cells adapt by physically bumping into things. A cell hits a toxin, it chemically reacts.
Right.
But human beings introduce a completely new layer of complexity. We don't just react to physical stimuli. We can sit in an empty room and imagine a future that doesn't exist yet.
We can worry about a threat that is miles away.
Exactly. We think. We model the world. Which brings us to the section of the monographs dealing with reflective organization.
Reflective organization.
Up until now, we've been talking about generative organization, where a system organizes physical matter or directs social actions.
Yeah.
Reflective organization is the moment a system develops the capacity to construct internal representations of its environment.
So it's building a model inside its head.
Exactly. And it requires what the framework calls second-order exclusion.
Second-order.
Yeah. At this level, we aren't just organizing molecules or building physical fences. We are organizing symbols, concepts, and ideas.
Right.
Our brains are constantly bombarded by millions of sensory inputs every second. If we didn't systematically exclude 99% of that data, we would be paralyzed by the noise.
Oh, absolutely.
We exclude countless interpretations to maintain a coherent mental model of the world.
And the monographs give a fantastic specific name to this internal model, the holoscript.
Yes, the holoscript.
The holoscript is the internally generated symbolic network through which we interpret reality. But the dangerous part is that the holoscript is not objective reality.
No, it's not.
It is a highly curated, selective map. It only includes the data points and distinctions we have decided are meaningful.
The epistemological limit here is profound. We don't experience the universe directly. We experience our holoscript's translation of the universe.
The text uses an analogy for this that is incredibly sticky, the moving train.
I love that one.
Imagine you are born on a moving train. You can look out the windows and see the landscape rushing by, and you can draw maps of what you see.
Right.
But you can never step off the train to view the landscape from a stationary, objective perspective. You are always inside the vehicle.
Always.
We can never step outside our own human cognition to see the universe as it truly is. We can only refine our holoscript from within the confines of our own minds.
And to illustrate just how powerful and malleable this holoscript can be, the framework pulls in a brilliant example from classical literature.
Oh, right, from Homer's Odyssey.
Exactly. Specifically, the encounter with the Cyclops, Polyphemus.
Yeah.
Odysseus is trapped in a cave with this giant monster who is literally eating his man. Mm. He can't physically overpower the Cyclops.
It's too small.
Right, so he uses reflective organization to survive. He tells the monster his name is Nobody, or Outis in ancient Greek.
And then, when Odysseus finally stakes the Cyclops in the eye, Polyphemus screams to the other giants outside the cave, "Nobody is attacking me. Nobody is killing me."
Yeah. And what do the other giants do?
They just shrug and walk away, leaving him to suffer.
Exactly. Looking at that through the lens of the PSE framework reveals the underlying mechanics of deception. Odysseus didn't alter physical reality.
No, he didn't turn invisible or shrink in size.
He hacked the monster's holoscript.
He hacked his map.
Yes. By injecting a false symbol into the Cyclops' internal representational framework, he completely altered the physical outcome of the situation. It demonstrates that in a reflective system, manipulating the internal map is just as effective as manipulating the external territory.
Which makes the holoscript an absolute superpower. I mean, it allows us to invent language, collaborate on massive scales, build scientific theories, and outsmart monsters.
Yeah.
But it also introduces a terrifying vulnerability. If our internal maps are that dominant, it explains why incredibly smart people and wildly successful organizations end up driving themselves off a cliff.
This is the fatal flaw of reflective systems.
Yeah.
And it revolves around the tension between two key concepts, coherence and congruence.
Okay, let's break those down because this feels like the linchpin of the whole theory.
Coherence refers to internal consistency. It asks, does our holoscript make logical sense? Do our internal beliefs, rules, and symbols align perfectly with each other?
Okay, so that's coherence.
Congruence, on the other hand, measures external compatibility. It asks, does our internal holoscript actually match the shifting objective reality outside of our minds?
Okay, to ground this, imagine you have a street map of a major city.
Right.
It's beautifully printed, incredibly detailed, and the legend is perfectly color-coded. Every street connects logically to the next. That map is highly coherent.
It makes perfect internal sense.
Exactly. But overnight, a massive earthquake strikes and levels half the city. Bridges collapse. New chasms open up.
The map in your hands hasn't changed. It's still perfectly coherent.
But it has completely lost congruence.
Yes.
It no longer matches the external context. If you wake up the next morning and stubbornly use that perfectly coherent map to drive to work, you are going to accelerate your car straight into a ravine.
That phenomenon is what the framework labels congruence loss.
Congruence loss.
Reality shifts, but the internal map remains static. When an individual or an institution experiences congruence loss but refuses to update their map, they enter a dangerous state called transgression.
Transgression.
Transgression is the act of continuing to operate based on your internal coherence, even as it violently clashes with external reality.
Man, we see this in the corporate world constantly.
Oh, all the time.
Think about Kodak or Blockbuster Video. Internally, their business models were exquisitely coherent. The boardroom logic, the profit margins on film or late fees, it all made perfect mathematical sense within their walls.
Right.
But the external reality shifted to digital cameras and streaming. They suffered massive congruence loss, but they transgressed. They clung to their coherent maps, and it destroyed them.
They valued their internal story over the external environment. And the framework actually returns to the Odyssey to show how insidious this need for coherence can be on an individual level.
Oh, right. This part is fascinating.
Yeah, so after Odysseus successfully escapes the Kays by hiding behind the name Nobody, he gets his remaining men onto their ship and they sail away.
Right.
He is safe. He is successfully adapted to reality. But as they row away, he can't help himself. He stands up on the deck and screams back to shore. It was I, Odysseus of Ithaca, who blinded you.
He practically paints a target on his own back.
Yes.
He gives the monster his real name, which allows the Cyclops to pray to his father Poseidon to curse the ship. That one act of arrogance derails Odysseus for 10 years and gets every single one of his men killed.
It is a textbook definition of transgression.
Yeah.
Shouting his name served zero adaptive survival purpose. It was completely incongruent with the physical danger he was still in, so why do it?
Why?
Because his holoscript, his ego, his self-identity as a glorious, famous warrior demanded internal coherence. Being a nameless nobody violated his core identity. He literally risked his life and sacrificed his crew simply to validate his internal map.
Wow. This is where the theory gets genuinely unsettling, because if one man's need for internal coherence can cause a disaster, what happens when you scale that up? What happens when millions of people share the same broken map? How does an entire civilization transgress?
That question pulls us into the final major section of the monographs, shared reflective organization.
Okay.
Here, the texts explore how communication builds vast institutional holoscripts, and it requires a profound organizational redefinition of two very heavy philosophical concepts, good and evil.
Defining good and evil through systems theory, that is ambitious. How does it work?
Well, in the PSE framework, good is defined very pragmatically. Any organizational process that supports, maintains, or restores congruence with changing external context is considered good.
So adapting.
Right. It is the act of continually updating the map so people don't drive off the cliff.
I have to pause here and wrestle with this because defining good as just adapting your map feels a bit mechanical.
I get that.
And it raises a terrifying implication for the flip side. Does this framework just write off evil as a glitch in the system?
How do you mean?
Like, oh, the bureaucracy's map was outdated. Sorry about the millions of people who suffered. Doesn't that strip away human agency and let malicious actors entirely off the moral hook?
That is the immediate, visceral reaction most people have when they encounter this. But when you dig into the mechanics of it, it does the exact opposite.
Okay, explain.
It explains how systemic horror actually functions.
Mm-hmm.
The text defines evil as transgressive persistence.
Transgressive persistence.
It is a stabilized organizational condition where a system continually reproduces internally coherent patterns that cause massive systemic harm, specifically because they are totally incongruent with reality.
And yet the system fiercely defends those patterns anyway.
Exactly. So it's not a one-time mistake where someone misread the map. It's the stubborn, violent enforcement of a broken map while real people are being crushed by it.
Oh, wow.
Think about some of the most catastrophic periods in history. Look at something like Lysenkoism in the Soviet Union.
Right.
You had an ideological map of agriculture that was perfectly coherent with Marxist doctrine, but utterly incongruent with actual genetic biology.
And when the crops failed and millions starved,
the system didn't update its map. It doubled down. It exiled or executed the scientists who pointed out the incongruence. That is transgressive persistence.
That is terrifying.
Highly rational, deeply organized institutions can commit horrific atrocities without relying on every individual waking up and choosing malice. The system values its internal ideological coherence over the survival of its people.
The banality of evil translated into systems theory.
Exactly.
As long as the rules make internal sense, the bureaucrats will enforce them, even if the external result is famine or genocide. But how does the framework restore individual agency here? How are we not let off the hook?
The framework explicitly introduces two vital concepts to combat this: responsibility and ethics. And these aren't just vague moral feelings. They are defined as deliberate structural capacities. Responsibility is the organizational ability to accurately evaluate the real-world consequences of your actions.
And ethics.
Ethics is the formalized effort to revise and update the holoscript before transgression hardens into evil.
So it is actively stating that because we are reflective beings, because we have the cognitive ability to see that our map is flawed, we have an inescapable duty to update it.
Not only a duty, but an existential imperative. If we witness congruence loss, If we see the map leading us off a cliff and we choose not to engage in the ethical work of revising it, mm-hmm. we become complicit in that transgressive persistence.
Wow.
In this view, science, open public debate, and even provocative art aren't just cultural luxuries. They are vital ethical tools. They are the mechanisms a healthy civilization uses to constantly stress test its shared holoscript against reality, forcing it to adapt and restore congruence.
This has been a profound journey today. We started with the smallest possible microscopic distinction, just a chemical boundary separating the inside from the outside.
Yeah.
We watched that principle of systematic exclusion build biological cells and then scale up to create the human mind.
Mm.
We saw how that mind generates a holoscript, an internal map of reality, and how shared maps build global institutions.
Exactly.
And we tracked how the agonizing tension between internal coherence and external congruence governs the rise and the devastating collapse of whole civilizations.
It's a lot to take in.
It is. Yeah. I want to connect this vast theory directly back to you, the listener. Whenever you find yourself stubbornly clinging to a belief that is causing friction in your relationships, or when you notice your workplace strictly enforcing an archaic policy that completely ignores modern market realities, you aren't just experiencing annoyance.
No.
You are witnessing this exact theory playing out. You're caught in the tension between coherence and congruence. You are holding a map that no longer matches the territory.
That tension is the ultimate engine of change. It forces us to ask what assumptions we are desperately holding on to and what reality is demanding we let go of.
Which brings us to a critical question to leave you pondering. The texts make it clear that every boundary created by exclusion does two things simultaneously. It separates us from our environment, but it also creates the exact surface where we connect and interact with it.
Boundary is the point of contact.
Exactly. If human civilization is just one specific scale of organization operating within a much larger global or even planetary environment, what is the ultimate context we are currently excluding just to maintain our societal coherence?
Oh, man.
What massive external realities are we systematically ignoring to keep our comfortable economic and cultural maps intact? And perhaps the most urgent question of all, is it time for us to undergo the painful ethical work of consciously redrawing our boundaries before we face a planetary congruence loss we can't recover from?
A heavy, essential question to end on. Because the chisel never stops carving. The only question left is what we consciously choose to exclude.